right, we'll call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It's 1:55 it's Wednesday, the 15th, day after Valentine's Day. We have Senator Kelly with us, Senator Meyer with us, Senator, I almost called you the wrong name, Costello with us, and the other Senator Wilikowski, Senator Coghill, I didn't forget that name. Today, we're going to hear two bills. One of them is a bill, the SB 55, and my thing, it says omnibus bill, but if you look at the sponsor statement, it's pretty thin, and I'll tell you why in a minute. So Senate Bill 55 and then Senate Bill 5, which Senator Meyer will introduce to us. And so Senate Bill 55 and Senate Bill 54 are bills that we're going to that have been introduced to modify and answer some of the concerns that have been raised both publicly and privately with regard to criminal justice reform. And so Senate Bill 55 today is what we've referred to as the technical management bill, because it's not just a revisor technical only, it's actually how to make things work technical. What I'd like to do is I'd like to have Jordan Schilling come and go through it with us. And since he is both committee aide and presenter, if you need to pass a note or something, we'll just move it along here. So just a preface to this, there are things that the Commission on Criminal Justice has proposed to us, and they came, this is mostly out of recommendation number 14, which we showed in committee before, that deals with just more technical in nature issues that don't deal with the substantive policy issues. On Friday, it's my plan to get into the more policy-oriented substantive issues, and then we'll probably have a little bit of discussion. We'll get the Department of Law, we'll get other people to explain some things. We do have some people here that could help us on the technical issues. I do have a CS, but what I'd like to do before we adopt the CS, I want to go through the bill as it is in its order so that we can see when we adopt the CS what exactly that CS does. It'll become very clear rather than trying to move back and forth. We can go through the version that is before us right now, which is the D version. And is there any questions on process at this point? All right. So, Mr. Schilling, we have before us Senate Bill 55. I think the best thing to do is to go through it in its order, if you can, and tell us what's in the packet so that members can follow you closely as far as what's in the packet for a backup explanation, and then we'll go through the bill. Put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. So just to reiterate to the committee, this bill contains a lot of technical changes that the Commission has been gathering since passage. They've been cataloging, soliciting feedback, working with agencies and practitioners to figure out what needs to be changed this year. And these recommendations ultimately came to the legislature a few weeks ago. They mostly contain technical revisions. Some are to clarify intent. Some are to fix simple drafting errors. And so if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I can just go through starting with Section 1 of the bill.
If you don't mind, we just wander right through it to show you. And then if there's a question at this point, I think go ahead and ask. And I think we can do clarification as we go through, because each one deals with some very specific thing. Mr. Schilling, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the first three sections all do the same thing. The Commission recommended in 2016 to raise the felony theft threshold and then subsequently link it to inflation and to inflation-proof that number so that the legislature would not need to make statutory changes as inflation eroded that threshold. In order to inflation-proof all of the different thresholds, about 14 of them, required many, many sections of Senate Bill 91 to do this. And there was a drafting error that linked three larger amounts to that inflation adjustment. So the $25,000 amount, grand larceny, has inadvertently been a provision has been inserted that adjusts it for inflation every 5 years. That adjustment has not occurred, this bill would remove the inflation adjustment for those three larger amounts that were never recommended or intended by Senate Bill 91.
And that's a policy call. If we ever wanted to change them at this point, it's just taking that policy call and leaving it as it is, best I understand. All right. Continue.
So Section 4 of the bill eliminates a penalty overlap for possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. So currently, under law, if an individual who were under 21 and were not legally possessing marijuana, if they were possessing less than an ounce, they could simultaneously be charged with an A misdemeanor or a B misdemeanor. There's an overlap. And in order to make it so that that offense is only one classification of misdemeanor, this bill would leave possession of less than an ounce as a B misdemeanor, how it has always been in statute. Section 5 of the bill clarifies that the court shall only provide the sentencing information to the victim if practicable. So if you look at the language of the bill, what the court is required to provide per Senate Bill 91, the court is required to provide information to the victim that explains what the sentence might be, the potential for release, and also allows that victim to update their information with the VINE system, which is a Department of Corrections notification system. And so because many victims don't show up to hearings, many victims don't want to even be a part of some of these hearings, the court has been technically out of compliance with this provision. The court has not able to provide this form to individuals that don't come to these hearings. The court doesn't maintain a database of addresses of victims, and it's really also not their core function to keep track of victims. And so the court has just asked the commission, and the commission recommended that we insert language that says, if practicable, the court shall provide that form.
No questions. And if there's questions, stop me. Otherwise, we'll just move right along. Go ahead, Mr. Schilling.
Okay, so Sections 6, 7, and 8 all deal with the suspended entry of judgment. Suspended entry of judgment is a new concept created under Senate Bill 91. And what Section 6 does is it provides explicit authority to the court to suspend an entry of judgment. So this is the statute that authorizes the court to do a number of things. It authorizes the court to sentence individuals and impose probation and impose fines. And so when we create a new thing that can be imposed or suspended or just done by the court system, it's important to go into this statute and provide that explicit authority. That's what this does. And then the second aspect of the SEJ fixes is found in Section 7. Section 7 adds the words "was imposed," and the reason that that language needs to be inserted is because without it, it's confusion. Practitioners wonder what date we're talking about. Are we talking about the beginning date of the probation, the end date of the probation? Probation is a duration of time, and so if we're going to refer to the date of probation, it's kind of a grammatical thing, but we need to say "was imposed." Probation is something that's imposed. Section 8 is the final technical revision to the suspended entry of judgment. And as you can see on page 4 and page 5, we take the word "convicted" and we change it to "charged" all throughout. I think we do it 4 times. And the reason is twofold. The first is that in a suspended entry of judgment, an individual is not convicted. It's kind of inappropriate in this context to be talking about conviction. One of the points of the suspended entry of judgment is that the judgment is not entered and the individual is not truly convicted. And so it's important to, in the first three cases, to change the word "convicted" to "charged." Now the final part of that section where we change "convicted" to "charged" is found on line 17. And the reason that this, 17 on page 5, and the reason this one needs to be changed is for a slightly different reason. "Has been convicted of" means that a prior conviction is what precludes this individual from being eligible for a suspended entry of judgment. Well, The intent of the suspended entry of judgment is that an individual who is currently charged with domestic violence cannot access, cannot be eligible for a suspended entry of judgment. So it's important that we say we refer to the current charge that individual has rather than some previous conviction of domestic violence.
Senator Wilkowski has a question on that.
Just to clarify on the other parts, 1 through 4 in Section 8, is I assume that same rationale applies so that just read it out in here because I can see how this could possibly be a legal challenge one day. It says the court may not suspend the imposition or entry of judgment and may not defer prosecution under this section of a person who is charged with a violation of, et cetera, et cetera. When you're saying is charged with, you're referring to the charging at the time that the person is being, you're talking about that instant matter. You're not talking about a previous charge. Maybe we can just clarify that. You might probably do it a little bit more articulately than I just did, just so that there's no confusion out there with the courts.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. I don't know if the first three instances of changing convicted to charged, I don't think that the problem there is the same problem that exists in subsection 5 that I just described. I think that the reason we changed those first three is just because, and while it may be common in statute to refer to convictions, the suspended entry of judgment is unique in that there is no conviction. I view this as just kind of a drafting oversight.
I think what he's asking for is, does it refer to the issue that's under the suspension of imposition of judgment? Is that true?
Yeah, and I'm thinking of an event where someone is charged with a completely different crime. Maybe someone's charged with some sort of marijuana or drug-related crime, and they have previously, maybe a year or 2 years ago, been charged with a violation of AS 1141-100. I just want the record to be clear that we're not saying in that case you can't have a suspended imposition of sentence.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is absolutely the intent that when we refer to these offenses, we are only concerned with the current existing charge. This does not preclude an individual who had a prior conviction for one of these offenses. This does not preclude them from getting the suspended.
Or a prior charge under one of these things,
sure,
as we're changing it.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, moving on to Section 9. Section 9 is the statute that contains the maximum probation terms that can be imposed by the court. And Senate Bill 91 made some changes to these maximum probation term lengths. That said, there's a little confusion if you look at subsections 1 and 2. Subsection 1 creates a limit of 15 years for a felony sex offense, and subsection 2 is a 10-year limit for an unclassified felony under Title 11. Well, a felony sex offense can also be an unclassified felony under Title 11, so it's important to just simply add some language that says not listed in subsection 1.
So the deference right there is that the 15 years will always be the probation extension that may not exceed 15 years for a sex offender.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And that was probably the intent all along, but it obviously came to somebody's attention. All right. Next.
So next, section number 10. Symbol 91 contained a provision where an individual who had their license administratively revoked, if they were acquitted of driving under the influence or refusal, or if all of their charges were dismissed, that individual would have their license reinstated. And if you can see on lines 20 and 21, you'll see that there's a requirement that all of the charges be dismissed without prejudice. The intent of this policy is to reinstate the license regardless of whether the dismissal was with or without prejudice. This was a drafting oversight that was not caught during the process. And because the original intent was to reinstate the license regardless of the type of dismissal, we are removing the words without prejudice to just refer to any type of dismissal.
All right.
Section 11 of the bill, this is a statute where the Department of Corrections is required to gather and submit data to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission quarterly. And as you can see, there's a number of data points that need to be submitted to the commission. And if you look at subsection 6, that's on line 21, one of the things that the Department of Corrections is required to give to the commission is information on the earned compliance credit. If you recall from Senate Bill 91, there was a policy created whereby an individual would receive month-for-month credit for sustained compliance with the conditions of their probation or parole. And the earned compliance credit, there was a version for probation and there was a version for parole. We are requiring in Senate Bill 91 that the DOC submit data on the probation version of the policy. But in a drafting oversight, we left out the requirement that they also submit data to the commission on the parole version of that policy. So it's an increased reporting requirement for the Department of Corrections. Section number 12 resolves an issue with the fact that there were two, this provision aligns an issue that arose from having two bills going through the legislature at the same time that were working in similar policy areas. Last year there was a Senate Bill 165 that made some revisions to Title IV, is my understanding.
Right. And if there's questions on that, for your information, committee members, Mr. Piper is online with the Alcohol Safety Action Program, which this would particularly land in. And we also have Hillary Martin, and they're both available for questions. But please continue, Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Senate Bill 165 passed last year, and what it did is it made minor consuming alcohol a violation rather than a criminal offense. And it also provided that the fine for this violation may be reduced if the defendant were to successfully complete the ASAP program requirements. And because Senate Bill 165 provides for these juvenile offenders to go to ASAP, it's important that we use this technical revision bill to give the ASAP program explicit authority to accept these referrals coming from the court system.
I think the other thing is in Senate Bill 91, we actually narrowed the scope of the Alcohol Safety Action Program. And so in narrowing it, we kept them from being able to use the issue that was passed in House Bill 165 or Senate Bill 165. So this just aligns those two bills, basically.
That's correct.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, does this just refer to a minor in possession of alcohol, or does it also include like marijuana?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, my understanding is just, and this is in Title IV, and my understanding is that it's possession and consumption of alcohol.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and if, and the reason we're bringing these up in a technical way is if you have questions with people that have been involved in this, whether it's Department of Law or the ASAP program, this is a good time to ask, but pretty straightforward. And that's what I'm trying to show is the pretty straightforward language in this particular bill. So please continue unless there's questions. Please continue.
So Section 13 of the bill, these are the this is the repealer section. And as you can see, there are two things that are being repealed here. And the first one that's being repealed is actually an error, and I will take responsibility for that, Mr. Chairman. It was a miscommunication on my part with legislative legal. It's a good statute that should absolutely not be repealed and serves a good purpose. But the other statute that's being repealed, 3316.120H, is a reporting requirement that is unnecessary. Senate Bill 91 created a new type of parole called administrative parole. And while the bill was in the other body, the types of offenders that would be eligible for administrative parole were reduced. And following the reduction in eligibility, in other words, some types of offenders were excluded from being eligible. But the notification requirement for those types of offenders was not amended to correspond with that change. And so we've got a reporting requirement that's not necessary because Those offenders aren't even eligible for that type of parole, and a hearing would never even occur. So the Department of Corrections approached the commission with this and asked to have this unnecessary reporting requirement removed.
And that's the 3316120H?
That's correct.
All right. And is this I think, if I remember correctly, this is the section that we're going to also bring a CS involved in? Is this the section that's dealing with it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The only difference between the version before the members now, D, and the contemplated CS version J, the only difference is that 120A is not repealed in the CS.
Okay. And I'll bring that before us. I wanted to go all the way through this bill and kind of flag this as we move, because that's going to be the only place that is unique in one version over the other. Sorry. So we'll bring that up after we get finished with this go-through. Continue.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Section 14, these are the applicability provisions. And I do have Hillary Martin on the line if there are any specific questions. I'm not yet an expert on these provisions, it's my understanding that Hillary Martin's available if there are questions.
The applicability is kind of a unique challenge, so maybe we could ask, I'd like to get Hillary to just give us why it has to be in this bill and what are some of the unique challenges with applicability sections. So Hillary, are you available to visit with us?
Yes, this is Hillary Martin with Fresh Blair Legal Services.
If you could just give us both the concept and the substance of Section 14 so that we understand if it's a technical fix or if it's wandering into policy.
So generally speaking, with applicability sections, you're looking at, especially with criminal bills, it can be really important to look at when this change in either a crime or a sentence takes when it applies, and if you're changing the crime, if you're increasing the punishment, you need to be careful that you're not applying it to conduct that would already have been committed before the act becomes effective, because that could be an ex post facto violation. So what happens is you look at what the sections are and what they're changing and whether there needs to be an applicability to make it clear when it applies. So, for example, with A1, we are slightly changing the crime to remove the adjusted for inflation, and so it applies to offenses committed on or after the effective date.
Okay. So the way I understand it, Hillary, is if, for example, on some of the probation parole requirements, it had to be on or after, and the applicability, if we're changing the reporting requirements, has to be the application of that has to correspond with the time and history of their past. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, it kind of depends on what's happening with probation. You can make it for, like, the probation when the probation's ordered, but it could be for offenses committed before on or after. There are situations where, for example, if you're granting somebody probation or you're allowing them to get off probation earlier, you may want to apply it to people that are currently on probation. But it depends on what the changes you're making are. And
okay, well, let's do this so that I don't add any more confusion to it. Let's just walk down through what each one of these statutes deals with. The section, say, like on page 11, line 13, 14, 15, 16. And I think those need some explanation so that we know what we're talking about as far as application.
Yeah, so through the chair, so A1, 2, 3, and 4 are all changes to crimes. So sections 1, 2, 3, and 4, 1, 2, and 3 are removing the adjusted for inflation language, and in section 4 we're adding the additional reference to 1171060. And so those are, you know, you're changing an element of the crime, so that those are applying to offenses committed on or after the effective date of that section.
And 1255078D is same, but what's the charge under Title 12 there?
Mr. Chair, the 1275078D is the change to suspended entry of judgment.
All right, and then C is probation, and that's where you said that it could apply to somebody on probation, but it doesn't contemplate something that happened before the law was passed. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So there is a difference between an applicability section and retroactivity, and so the applicability section is basically saying that your so for 090C, it's for probation ordered on or after the effective date for offenses committed before on or after. So it depends on when your probation was granted. It doesn't go back to people who had probation granted previously. So this section would apply to anyone who was granted probation on or after the effective date.
And I think that's
regardless of when they had committed the offense.
And I think that's an important distinction because we contemplated that people would have a benefit of some of these new probation parole assessments going forward. So, okay, thank you. And then, the other one is the revocation. And that's just conforming to what DMV brought with... maybe you can explain sub D for us.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So this is the section that allows you to get your license back if you can request your license revocation be rescinded if you're acquitted or the charges are dropped for driving under the influence. And so in this case, that section is removing without prejudice, so it actually would apply to more people than it would have before, and so the applicability section, it's for a revocation that happened before on or after, for conduct occurring before on or after. So because you're actually granting a benefit so that people who had their license revoked but then their charges were dropped with prejudice could now take advantage of this when they couldn't before. And so since that's seen as a benefit, then it can apply before, on, or after the effective date.
And the way I understand it right now, the time frame of that is between the signing of Senate Bill 91 and the passage of this bill, basically.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct. Yes.
Okay. All right. And then Section 15, Jordan, if you want to, because I think that pretty much takes care of the applicability. Any other comments, Hillary, before I move on to Jordan?
No, I don't have anything else unless there are questions.
Any questions? Thank you. I think that navigated through the applicability. That helped me understand it better, too. I mean, every time I read that, my brain would not be able to follow it as clearly. So you did a good job of explaining it. Thank you. Jordan, next
Thanks,
section.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. The next section, Section 15, is kind of a continuance of the applicability provisions. This was brought to the Commission by the Department of Corrections. And they view this as very important. And what it does is simply says that any decision that any of the applicability provisions in Senate Bill 91 may not be construed as invalidating or nullifying a decision that the Board of Parole has made prior to January 1st, 2017. The Department of Corrections, with respect to extending the period of supervision beyond the maximum release date on the original sentence. The Department of Corrections felt that there was some ambiguity in some of the applicability provisions of Senate Bill 91, and they've asked for us to provide some clarity in this bill. Similarly, there is a little bit of question on the applicability provision with respect to earned compliance, the earned compliance credit for parolees. And what sub B does, that's line 4 on page 12, is ensures that the earned compliance credit is not given retroactively to individuals who served time on parole prior to January 1st, 2017. Okay. And then the next section of the bill provides for an immediate effective date.
Senator Wilkowski has a question on, I think, Section 15.
Thank you. Yeah, on the dates, you picked January 1st, 2017 for in compliance and for decisions of the Board of Parole. Is there a reason we wouldn't want to make it the date that this bill became effective as opposed to January 1st? Because then this, we're probably looking at weeks, if not months, before this is signed. Any thought about making it effective the date the bill goes into effect?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, this applicability provision in Section 15 does go into effect immediately, but what it does is it ensures that credit, for example, prior to the time that credit went effective, is not awarded to offenders because the Earned Compliance Program didn't even exist prior to January 1st, 2017. So Section 15 does take effect immediately when this bill is passed and signed. And it will have the effect of ensuring that credit for a credit that didn't exist is not applied retroactively to individuals who don't earn.
I think probably a simpler way of saying it is in Senate Bill 91, the effective date was that date that they would start counting those benefits. And there was no counting before that. So Senate Bill 91 contemplated that they would start counting on that date. So Senator Wilkowski?
But just on Section A of 15, for example, there, I don't know when the Board of Parole meets, but if they issued a decision, say February 1st, then this bill could invalidate that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, if the board extended the period of supervision beyond the maximum release date, and they had taken that action prior to January 1st, 2017, then yes, this bill would ensure that those decisions stay in place and are firm and they're not invalidated.
Okay. I misplaced the before and after, so I got you. Thanks.
All right.
And Mr. Chairman, that is the 16 sections of Senate Bill 55.
It took about the right time. I figured it'd take us half an hour to go through it. This is to lay out why we thought these fixes were reasonably technical or enough to show that implementation issues needed to be addressed. So what I'd like to do, though, is I'd like to take you over to the CS and show you why I would like to adopt the CS as our working document. If you go, I think in your packet you have the J version, and if you just bring that up, and once again, Jordan, if you could show us where exactly the difference is, or do you have it?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have the CS before me, but it's in the repealer section, Section 13.
I'm sorry. You don't have staff to get one to you either, do you?
So Section 13 of the bill in the CS only repeals one section of law, one subsection of law.
That's up by page 11, line 8.
Mm-hmm.
And in the new version, we would only have the AS 3316120H repeal.
That's correct.
And just explain again what that 102H is.
Sure. Senate Bill 91 created a type of parole called administrative parole. The eligibility was narrowed when the bill was in the other body, but the notification requirements were not narrowed to correspond with the narrowing of the eligibility. So right now there is a notification requirement that exists that is not relevant because those individuals don't access administrative parole.
So with that, I would like to make a motion that we have the CS for Senate Bill Number 55 Judiciary Version J as our working document. Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, then we will adopt the Version J as the CS for Senate Bill Number 55 with that correction in it. And I'm going to set this bill aside, and for those of you who have been listening in, we have heard, that there are still yet some pieces that have yet to percolate up to us as far as things that are really technical in nature, like they've been described here in this particular bill. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to hold this bill over while we vet those with Department of Law, Corrections, you know, the various people that are affected, so that when we bring them before the committee, they're easily explained and fit within the scope of what we're trying to do in this bill. So if there's any further questions for my committee aide, we can certainly point you to the experts in the Department of Law, the defense councils, or wherever, DMV, Alcohol Safety Action Program, wherever we need to go to find if there's any nuances to some of these repair pieces in this bill. Any further comments or questions at this point? Thank you, Jordan. With this, we're going to lay the CS for Senate Bill number 55 aside. We'll pick it up at a later date. And the next thing we'll do is we'll take a brief at ease while we get Senate Bill 5 up. We'll take it easy. All right, we'll call the Judiciary Committee back to order. And next before us is Senator Meyer's Senate Bill 50, number 5 on contribution limits. And Senator, do you want to make some opening statements and then have your staff come forward?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just briefly, the intent of bringing forward SB 5 is to help eliminate the appearance of corruption within our campaign finance system. Back in 1996, there was a major campaign finance reform bill, and it prohibited legislators and people running for office to collect money from lobbyists unless that lobbyist lived within their district. But what we found in this last election was that there is a loophole that a legislator or a person running for office could set up their own PAC.
And they could, a political action committee.
Yes, thank you, political action committee. And they could raise money for that. Now, obviously, that money couldn't be used for themselves during the campaign, but it wouldn't prohibit myself, for example, raising money for a PAC and giving you a contribution, and you having your own PAC and you give me a contribution. So the it's just the appearance of us legislators or people running for office being able to collect money anytime from a lobbyist. That was never the intent, I believe, of the campaign finance reform. And so basically what this bill will do, and this was brought to my attention actually by a constituent. There was a complaint filed to APOC, which is Alaska
Public
Office Commission. Thank you. And you know, they basically said that there's nothing they could do. It is a loophole in our current law. So that's why we're bringing this bill forward. There was an opinion piece in the ADN about this. So there's been a lot of people. I think everybody agrees that it's not a good thing to do, and basically what it does is it prohibits a political group controlled by a legislator from soliciting or accepting contributions during a legislative session, and it prohibits registered lobbyists from contributing to a political group that is controlled by a legislator or a candidate for the legislature. Now, what I'd like to do at this time, Mr. Chairman, is have my staff, Edward Morledge, come up and walk through the bill a little bit. It's fairly typical of a lot of bills that we do. It's long, but it really just does one or two simple things. So if I could ask Edward to join us and walk us through that quickly.
Sure, Edra. Welcome to the table. Put yourself on the record, and how you want to walk us through this is entirely up to you. So we're ready for you to explain the bill to us.
Okay, thank you, Chair Coghill, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Edra Moylidge, staff to Senator Meyer, and he did a pretty good synopsis of what the bill does. It is pretty simple. The longest part of the bill is the definition section, which we're not actually changing. We did have an original draft that was found to have a drafting error, and so that's the reason why we have the most current version is a CS in front of you. The easiest way to explain what the drafting error was is to go through the sectional summary, if you'd like me to do that.
I think that would be fine.
Okay.
That's a good way to get introduced to the bill.
Okay.
No, this is a committee sub. I mean, a sponsor substitute, right? Oh, hold it. So the version U is the CS that you would like to adopt. Is that the deal?
No, Mr. Chair. That was the CS that was adopted in the previous
committee.
That's what
I thought. Yeah. And you had done. Okay. All right. Good.
So Section 1 is a new section which places restrictions on solicitation and acceptance of contributions by groups controlled by legislators or candidates for legislature, for the state legislature, during a legislative session. So that's a new section. The original version also included in that section the restriction on expending funds during a legislative session, which we actually still have in the bill. It's just that those were both contained in the same section in the original bill, and they needed to be broken apart because they're two different sections of this chapter.
Okay.
So, Section 2 is rewritten to prohibit lobbyist contributions to candidates for the state legislature or to groups that are controlled by a sitting legislator or a candidate for the legislature. Section 3 regards prohibited contributions, and this is the new section. This section makes an exception for contributions by lobbyists eligible to vote only in that candidate's district, which is part of current law, but for the purposes of this, of drafting this bill, they're broken out into these new sections. Section 4 is limitations on expenditures, and this is the new section pertaining just to these groups controlled by legislators or candidates for the state legislature. And this basically brings these groups in line with how individual candidates operate, which is no expenditures during a legislative session. And finally, Section 5 is the definition section. And one sentence or some words that were added to the definition, the introduction of the definitions, which is on page 2, line 28 and 29. The drafter of the bill put in the words, unless the context clearly requires otherwise, and then goes on into the definitions. And that's just to remove any sort of legal ambiguity that might be construed by the definitions so that they apply just to this chapter. And that is the sectional summary.
And the contributions, I take it, at this point, are still within context of what's already in law?
That's correct, sir.
Questions? So we have Senator Costello, and then we'll get to Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this legislation. I considered introducing similar legislation myself because I felt like it was skirting the intent of the law. My question is on page 2, line 11, where it says that it starts out an individual required whatever, and then it says goes on to say in which the individual is eligible to vote or will be eligible to vote on the date of the election, and we're talking about the lobbyist here, and I'm concerned just about the word eligible to vote. Obviously, what we're getting at here is that somebody who's perhaps just a lobbyist who's moved into the district and then or is planning to move into the district and is eligible to vote. My question is, what if, I mean, there's a difference between eligible to vote and able to vote because they may not change their registration. So I just wanted to make sure that language is tight enough to not allow for some activity where you have lobbyists saying that they're intending, you know, to move into a district perhaps. And then I'll ask my other question, which is basically, what does it mean, is controlled by? And you find that on page 2, line 2, page 1, line 7. I think the intent is that the person is a part of this political action committee, but controlled by indicates that they might have just control of it, but they may not be listed as, you know, as a participating member. And I was wondering if you had any conversations with the drafter of the legislation to see whether or not that is the appropriate word that we're looking for.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Costello, this is Edra Morledge again. To answer your first question in regards to lobbyist contributions, that is actually an existing section in statute now. So we didn't change any of that section. It's just relettered little J, whereas it used to be G. So we didn't contemplate perhaps a lobbyist maybe moving to a new district. We didn't contemplate those concerns that you raised. We didn't actually try to make any adjustments to that section of the chapter. For your second question, the controlled by did come up, and I asked for clarification and perhaps some guidance as to how the Alaska Public Offices Commission might interpret controlled by from our drafter, and I believe he's online to answer some of those questions. He did include his answers to me in a legal memo, which you should have in your packets, and it's quite lengthy, and I'm not a legal expert, so I asked him to be online to answer some of those questions.
We have Alpheus Ballard, and I think we have Heather Hedden from the APOC. So do you want to ask one of those a question?
Sure.
All right, proceed.
I guess my question is for Alpheus. You know, the words controlled by, is that adequate for what the intention of the bill is?
Through the chair, Senator Costello. This is Alpheus Ballard, Legislative Counsel, Legislative Legal Services. And controlled by, that term or phrase, is not defined for the purposes of the bill. Not being defined, that means that it's left to the Alaska Public Offices Commission to define in regulation. If the legislature chooses not to provide a specific definition for the purposes of the bill's provisions, I don't think it's too great a grant of legislative discretion to allow the commission to decide what controlled by might mean in this instance. I think that the sense of controlled by is something that would be fairly easy to, well, who knows, but it could be divined on the facts of each case.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Alpheus. I appreciate it. You had a further question, or shall I move on?
No.
Senator Wilkowski, you also had a question.
Thank you, and probably for Edra. So this bill would still allow for political action committees to give to legislators who are controlling PACs. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, that's correct.
Okay. How about people from out of state? Would they still be prohibited? And what would be the limits of what could be accepted? I know for Senate it's 5,000, for House it's 3. Are there limits, if any?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, there are, and they're very intricate and complicated, so I would defer that question to the commission, which I know they're online to be able to answer those specific questions.
Do you want to pursue that with APOC, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, if it's somebody can answer real quick, I'm just curious.
So, Heather Hedden, are you on, and can you hear us?
Through the chair, yes. Would you mind repeating the question? I know it was contribution limits, but as they apply to who?
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. So what I understand this legislation to do is that this is to address a situation where legislators set up political action committees. And I'm just curious what the out-of-state, how much out-of-state money a legislator could take under those circumstances. and if they could take out-of-state PAC money.
As far as the legislator accepting contributions, Senator Wilkowski,
you're talking about the PAC accepting the contribution.
Yeah. So in this situation, this is prohibiting. This is dealing with legislators who set up political action committees, and I'm curious how much those political action committees can accept from outside of Alaska, and how much. I asked the question of whether or not they can take money from other political action committees, and I think the answer to that is yes, but if you could just clarify that.
Through the chair, yes, Senator Wilkowski, that is correct. They could accept contributions from other groups. As far as groups based outside of Alaska, there are limits that pertain to those as well. Generally, groups outside of Alaska are not permitted to contribute to a candidate. But they could, with limits, form the group, register a group from out of state. However, 90% of their contributions must be from Alaska residents. Okay. So it would not change the group's contribution limits. They would be able to accept $500 from individuals. But the scale slides, they cannot accept 90% of their contributions must be from Alaska residents. Sorry if that isn't all that clear.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, that's helpful. And can they take money from outside PACs? So political action committees outside of Alaska, could that compose the 10% of the outside funds they receive?
Yes, but they would be limited to a $1,000 contribution limit from that outside PAC.
Right. And another question, Senator?
I could, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And then could the legislator controlling this political action committee contribute money to his or her own campaign or do an independent expenditure for his or her own campaign with using these funds from this political action committee they control?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes. As far as direct contributions to their own campaign, they would, of course, be limited to the $1,000. As far as making independent expenditures on behalf of their own personal campaign, that would be unlimited.
Just on that point, my understanding has always been there you couldn't coordinate between independent expenditure groups and the candidate. So if a legislator controls the PAC, isn't that coordination?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is part of staff's concern with not defining the term controlled by.
That's an excellent point, Senator. That's something we might want to ponder as we keep this bill here to think it through, because I think our general understanding is that independent expenditures have to have an arm's length from campaigns, and that's always a management problem anyway in a small community, but it would even be more complicated if the candidate was running, supposed to be arm's length from their own campaign. So. Well said. Well, good point, and I think that's something we need to ponder before we move this thing along. Any other questions? Senator Wilkowski?
For the sponsor, is there a reason we're not just banning these groups from forming?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, Edra Moore-Litch again. I believe that banning these groups would pose First Amendment infringements on an individual's right to direct their funds as free speech towards a political towards a political statement that they'd like to make. We did research that at the beginning just to see what our various options were, and just placing these couple of sideboards seemed to be the best route, just to bring them in line with basically how candidates have to operate their own campaigns. We didn't contemplate doing an overhaul of the campaign finance structure or making any big groundbreaking new changes to it. We just merely wanted to close this loophole that was discovered last year and make some small changes.
You'd be interesting on the First Amendment right question, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, on that point, I wonder if Alpheus is still on board and maybe he could give us some rationale. I know I saw a legal opinion that Senator Meyer got, and it talks about legitimate government interest in restricting campaign contributions, and it would seem to me that that would be a legitimate governmental interest to say candidates cannot have their own political action committees where they can essentially raise unlimited amounts of money that it appears they can use in their own campaigns and effectively skirt our entire campaign finance laws. But I'm curious what legal has to say if they're still on the line, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bullard, are you able to articulate an answer to that question?
Senator Coghill, Chair, I am. Senator Wilkowski, if a legislator forms a PAC and then that PAC makes contributions or expenditures that help that legislator's own campaign, then that group will be defined as part of, as the candidate under 1513-400-1A or 1B. Subparagraph 5, and the contributions to that group will be aggregated with contributions to the candidate for purposes of our campaign finance statutes. That group is no longer just a political action committee. It is a political action committee that is one and the same with the candidate's campaign. So it's a scenario that is already contemplated and addressed by existing law.
So, Mr. Bullard, then the question of an arm's length is really not the question, because once they do that combination, they can't be considered an independent expenditure then. Is that true?
Senator Coghill, that is my conclusion.
Okay, all right.
I can also answer the rest of Senator Wilkowski's question.
All right.
About whether it would be a narrow, tailored remedy to prohibit all legislative PACs. At present, the only rationale accepted by the United States Supreme Court for limiting campaign contributions is corruption and the threat of corruption. A PAC that has the ability to sort of circumvent existing contribution limits to legislators, that poses the threat of corruption. If there is, say, a ballot proposition, say an initiative on the ballot that a particular legislator has strong feelings about and wishes to use their firepower to help raise money towards that end, I don't know that preventing the existence of a group like that, it relates to a ballot proposition over which the legislature will exercise very little control, whether prohibiting the existence of that group could be construed to be narrowly tailored to prevent corruption or corruption. That's my conclusion, that that a court would not find that it was.
Senator Costello has a question, and we'll get back to Senator Wilkowski. Or on that point, Senator Wilkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I can see on a ballot initiative. I'm just wondering, collecting campaign contributions to provide to other candidates. Is that, do you think the court would say that would, you could narrowly tailor the bill enough to prohibit that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I haven't examined that question. I don't know what a court would find in that instance.
Senator Costello, you had something to chime in on?
Thank you.
Question for Alpheus?
Yes.
All right. Forward.
So on page 2, line 4, and then also on page 2, line 26,
we're specifically shining a light on the state legislature. And actually on page 1, line 9, I mean, we're talking about the legislature over and over again. And so I'm curious if there was any contemplation of using a broader term, for example, a person who files for public office. And I mean, I'm sure that there are assembly candidates or perhaps school board candidates or, you know, candidates for, you know, Congress who we would also want to have these types of abuses prevented. So I'm just curious if we had talked about using a broader term like public office.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, that may be a better question directed to the sponsor of the legislation.
And why don't we do that? Let's see if the senator or his staff had contemplated any broader language. Title 15 probably being mostly focused on legislature, but Senator?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think at the federal level, they have different rules or guidelines than we do at the state level. But certainly, I believe the school board members and assembly members, they do, I think Senator Costello is correct, I think they have to follow the same rules and guidelines as we do, and so I wouldn't be opposed to changing that, but I don't know. Maybe, Edward, do you have any other thoughts?
So let's do this. I'm going to set the bill aside. I just wanted us to have an introduction to it, but if you could work with the senator and his staff, maybe there's some broadening language that you can work on, and we'd be glad to entertain that in committee. And actually, that goes for the entire bill, whether it's the scope of the PACs or whatever. So I don't want to necessarily put Senator Meyer's bill totally on the chopping block, but I wanted good thought to go into it as we move along.
May I make one comment?
Senator Costello?
So in this bill, candidate is defined as meaning an individual who files for, and it goes on to list legislature, governor, light gov, municipal office. So my thought would be maybe instead of saying up in page 2, line 4, instead of indicating that it's someone who files for election to the state legislature, we just say it's an individual who becomes a candidate. And once you file for office, you're a candidate. So I'll just throw that out there.
So for reporting purposes, we almost always talk about public office, so election to public office, and then we just have to see if that fits fairly well. But and I think the transparency of our reporting requirements are also a big part of the accountability measures. It's not just the narrowness of the law or the prohibition, but it's the fact that it's reported and brought to people's attention. I only bring that up as part of the context of when we're looking at if somebody as a candidate was had a PAC, how that would be reported. And I think it was fairly well reported during this last election cycle, and it had its own impact. So just as part of the context to it. Further questions for the sponsor or the staff of the sponsor? So I'm going to let it sit there. I'll let you work with some of the members of the committee on some of the questions that they've risen. I'll give you a chance to look through some of the legal memos that have gone through there. We'll set this bill aside and bring it up at a further date. So thank you, committee members, for being here. The reward for being here and being patient is you get out early. Unless there's any other business to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned.